I am Hmong. For the Hmong, it is never everyone for himself. Jonas was thin and wiry and handsome, although like almost every well-educated Hmong I knew, he always looked dog-tired. His real name was Veng Na. He had changed his name to Jonas Vengé when he was living in France because he thought that his resume would garner more job offers if he did not sound so Asian. He now had two jobs as a bilingual education specialist for the Merced school system and as a Hmong language teacher at Merced College. I used to talk to him using a mixture of English and French in an elementary school classroom seated again at a child's desk. I never asked a question about Hmong history or linguistics that he was unable to answer. Because, like Blia, Jonas was always busy but never turned me away, I decided to find a way to thank him for his help. Should I give him a gift? This seemed hazardous. He might feel he should reciprocate. Also, I didn't trust my gift-selecting instincts. Once, in an attempt to bridge the miles between Laos, Merced, and New York City, I had given Fo and Nakao a small plastic globe, only to find that they believed the earth was flat. Should I invite Jonas and his wife to Bill Selvage's house? This might confuse them. There was no recognized Hmong category for platonic friends who shared living quarters. Why don't you invite them to a nice restaurant? Suggested Bill. So one evening, at 7 o'clock sharp, I sat waiting for Jonas in the lounge at a local steakhouse called the Cask and Cleaver. He had told me his wife could not join us because she had to take care of their children. I suspected he might also be embarrassed because her English was rudimentary. The restaurant's hostess, who wore a silver lame top and a miniskirt, asked me whom I was waiting for. "A Hmong man who has helped me with my work," I said. The hostess looked surprised. "I just moved to Merced," she said, "and I don't know nothing about the Hmongs. I just saw my first one today. My boyfriend said, 'That's a Hmong.' I said, 'How can you tell the difference? They look just like Chinamen to me.' My boyfriend says they're the worst drivers in the world. When he sees one, he goes clear across town to stay away from them. I guess Hmongs don't come to restaurants like this very often." "They sure don't," I thought. "And by the way, you're not fit to polish Jonas's boots." Jonas arrived 45 minutes late, saying he had been delayed by a student. I never knew if he had known from the start that he couldn't make it at 7 and had agreed to the time because he thought that was what I wanted to hear, or whether the story of his life, he had once again been pulled in two mutually exclusive directions. The dinner was not a success. Despite his 5 languages, Jonas had difficulty understanding the waitress, a teenager who spoke Rapid Valley Girl and had to ask me several times what she was saying. Out of politeness, certainly not from lack of sophistication, since he had eaten at plenty of Parisian restaurants that would make the Cask and Cleaver look like McDonald's, he ordered the cheapest entree on the menu. Our conversation was formal and halting. Jonas was obviously relieved when we left. Afterwards, we stood in the parking lot, talking in the dark. "You know, Anne," he said quietly, "when I am with a Hmong or a French or an American person, I am always the one who laughs last at a joke. I am the chameleon animal. You can place me any place, and I will survive, but I will not belong. I must tell you that I do not really belong anywhere." Then Jonas drove home to his wife, his 3 children, his brother, his brothers' wives, his brothers' 10 children, and his ringing telephone. Chapter 17. The 8 Questions. Leah did not die, nor did she recover. Fo often dreamed that her daughter could walk and talk, but when she awoke, Leah lay curled next to her in bed, a slight, silent husk who hardly seemed big enough to contain her family's load of memory, anger, confusion, and grief. She lay suspended in time, growing only a few inches, gaining little weight, always looking far younger than her age, while the Lee siblings who still lived at home, six athletic bilingual children who moved with ease between the Hmong and American worlds, grew up around her. Cheng joined the Marine Reserves and was called to serve in the Gulf War, but to Fuo's nearly hysterical relief, the war ended 2 days before his scheduled flight to Saudi Arabia. Mei went to Fresno State University, majoring in health science, a choice influenced by her childhood experiences, both positive and negative, as the ad hoc arbitrator between her parents and the medical establishment. Yer, a volleyball star who had won the award for Best Girl Athlete at Merced High School, joined Mei at Fresno State 2 years later, majoring in physical education. Tru became Merced High's student body treasurer and president of its Youth Culture Club, a Hmong social and service organization with more than 200 members. Mai became a standout soccer player and was known as one of the most beautiful teenagers in Merced, a reputation that caused most boys to fight over her and girls all too frequently to resent her. Peng grew from a harum-scarum toddler into a self-possessed schoolgirl with a flair for traditional Hmong dance. There were a few tremors as the Lee children passed through adolescence, but never the rifts that American families accept almost as a matter of course. "My parents are the coolest parents in the world," Tru once wrote me. "We don't have anything in the world, but we do have the closeness of us eight sisters, one brother, and our parents. This is the coolest family ever, and I would never trade it for anything else in this world." Nikau gained weight and was troubled by high blood pressure. Fuo felt tired much of the time. Seeing that their energies were waning, Janine Hilt urged the Lees to let Leah return to the Shelby Center for Special Education each day. Not to educate her, that was a thing of the past, but to give her parents a few hours' respite each day. Because of their persistent fear that Leah might be stolen from them again by the government, the Lees were reluctant at first. But because they trusted Janine, they eventually agreed. Dee Korda, one of whose foster children was severely retarded and also attended Shelby, frequently saw Leah there, lying on her back with her hands strapped to blocks in order to prevent her fingers from stiffening into claws. She could hardly bear to look. The Cordas had all taken Leah's neurological catastrophe hard. The entire family had gone through therapy at the Merced County Mental Health Department in order to deal with what Dee called Leah being dead but alive. At their counselor's suggestion, the children, biological, foster, and adopted, drew pictures on butcher paper. "Wendy drew a mom and a baby because Leah was with her mom," said Dee. "Julie drew a rainbow with clouds and birds because Leah didn't have to cry anymore. Maria is real withdrawn, but when we told her about Leah, she cried. Leah got through to her. She drew a broken heart with a jagged fence and an eye looking in from the outside. The heart was the sadness. The fence was the wall that Leah had gotten over by touching our lives, and the eye was my eye, watching the sadness with the tear that cried. In 1993, while she was vacationing at Disneyland, Janine Hilt had an acute asthma attack, went into respiratory failure, and suffered oxygen deprivation so severe that she lost all brain function. In other words, she developed hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy, exactly the same fate that had befallen Leah. She died 3 days later with her partner of 18 years, Karen Marino, at her side. "When I heard Jenny was dead, my heart broke," Fuo told me. "I cried because Jenny had told me that she wasn't going to get married and she would never have any children of her own, so she would help me raise my children. But she died, so she couldn't do that, and I felt I had lost my American daughter. Neil Ernst won the MCMC Residency Program's first Faculty Teacher of the Year award. Peggy Philp became Merced's County Health Officer, a post her father had held more than 40 years earlier. They continued to share their pediatric practice as well as housework and childcare, scrupulously negotiating what one of their Christmas letters described as a blur of laundry, lunches, cleaning, patient care, newborn resuscitation, and resident teaching. Their understanding of the Lees and the Lees' understanding of them deepened significantly when they, too, experienced a child's grave illness. During his last month of third grade, their elder son, Toby, was diagnosed with acute lymphocytic leukemia. When Neil tried to tell Dan Murphy about the diagnosis, he cried so hard he couldn't talk. After one of Leah's checkups, Neil wrote me. Mrs. Lee had heard that our son had leukemia. It was truly amazing how quickly she heard of this. When Peggy saw Leah in our clinic, Mrs. Lee was very concerned about Toby's health, how he was doing, etc. There was very genuine concern expressed by her questions and facial expression. At the end of the visit, Mrs. Lee was hugging Peggy and they were both shedding a few tears. Sorrows of motherhood cut through all cultural barriers. Toby underwent 3 years of chemotherapy and achieved what seems to be a permanent remission. Leah's mother continues to occupy a special place in our thoughts, wrote Neil in a later letter. She always asks about Toby. Our contacts with her are very infrequent because her family provides excellent care for Leah, but they are special nonetheless. Since Leah's brain death, whatever scant trust Fo and Nicole had once had in American medicine had shrunk to almost zero. I say almost because Fo exempted Neil and Peggy. When their daughter May broke her arm and the doctors in the MCMC emergency room told them it needed a cast, Nicole marched her straight home, bathed her arm in herbs, and wrapped it in a poultice for a week. May's arm regained its full strength. When a pot of boiling oil fell from the electric stove onto Fo's skirt, setting it on fire and burning her right hip and leg, she sacrificed 2 chickens and a pig. When Fo got pregnant with her 16th child and had an early miscarriage, she did nothing. When she got pregnant with her 17th child and had a complicated miscarriage in her 4th month, Nicao waited for 3 days until she started to hemorrhage and fell unconscious to the living room floor before he called an ambulance. He consented to her dilation and curettage only after strenuous, in fact desperate, persuasion by the MCMC resident on obstetric rotation. Nicole also sacrificed a pig while Fo was in the hospital and a 2nd pig after she returned home. Before she was readmitted to Shelby, Leah was routinely vaccinated against diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus. At about the same time, she started to develop occasional seizure-like twitches. Because they were brief and infrequent and benign, and also perhaps because he had learned from bitter experience, Neil decided not to prescribe anticonvulsants. Fo and Nicao were certain that the shots had caused the twitches, and they told Neil that they did not want Leah to be immunized ever again, for anything. Dan Murphy, who became the director of MCMC's Family Practice Residency Program, once told me that when you fail one Hmong patient, you fail the whole community. I could see that this was true. Who knew how many Hmong families were giving the hospital a wide berth because they didn't want their children to end up like the 2nd youngest Lee daughter? Everyone in Merced's Lee and Yang clans knew what had happened to Leah. Those bad doctors. Just as everyone on the pediatric floor at MCMC knew what had happened to Leah. Those bad parents. Leah's case had confirmed the Hmong community's worst prejudices about the medical profession and the medical community's worst prejudices about the Hmong. At the family practice clinic, the staff continued to marvel at the quality of care the Lees provided to their clean, sweet-smelling, well-groomed child. But at the hospital next door, where the nurses had had no contact with Leah since 1986, the case metastasized into a mass of complaints that grew angrier with each passing year. Why had the Lees been so ungrateful for their daughter's free medical care? Neil, who did not share the nurse's resentment, once calculated that over the years, Leah had cost the United States government about $250,000, not counting the salaries of her doctors, nurses, and social workers. Why had the Lees always insisted on doing everything their way? Why, this was still the worst sin had the Lees been noncompliant? As Sharon Yates, a nurse's aide, told me, "If only the parents had given Leah the medicine, she wouldn't be like this. I bet when she came back from that foster home, they just didn't give her any medicine." But I knew that when she returned from foster care, Four and Nakao had given Leah her medicine. 4 cc's of Depakine 3 times a day, exactly as prescribed. Hoping to clear up some questions about Leah's anticonvulsants, I went to Fresno to talk with Terry Hutchison, the pediatric neurologist who had overseen her care at Valley Children's Hospital. I had noticed that in one of his discharge notes, written 9 months before her neurological crisis, he had described Leah as a very pretty Hmong child, and her parents as very interested and very good with Leah. I had never seen phrases like that in her MCMC chart. Bill Selvidge had told me that Dr. Hutchison was a known eccentric, beloved by his residents for his empathy, but dreaded for his insistence on doing rounds at 4 a.m. He had an exiguous crew cut, and on the day I met him, was wearing a necktie decorated with a large, bright, yellow giraffe. A sign in the hall outside his office hung at toddler eye level, read, "Kid Zone. Enter with care and love." When I asked him about the relationship between Leah's medications and her final seizure, he said, "Medications probably had nothing to do with it." "Huh?" I said. Leah's brain was destroyed by septic shock, which was caused by the Pseudomonas aeruginosa bacillus in her blood. I don't know how Leah got it, and I will never know. What I do know is that the septic shock caused the seizures, not the other way around. The fact that she had a pre-existing seizure disorder probably made the status epilepticus worse or easier to start or whatever. But the seizures were incidental and not important. If Leah had not had seizures, she would have presented in a coma and shock, and the outcome would have probably been the same, except that her problem might have been more easily recognized. It was too late by the time she got to Valley Children's. It was probably too late by the time she got to MCMC. Did her parents' past noncompliance have anything to do with it? Absolutely nothing. The only influence that medications could have had is that the Depakine we prescribed might have compromised her immune system and made her more susceptible to the Pseudomonas. Depakine occasionally causes a drop in white blood cells that can hamper the body's ability to fight infection. I still believe Depakine was the drug of choice, and I would prescribe it again. But, in fact, if the family was giving her the Depakine as instructed, it is conceivable that by following our instructions, they set her up for septic shock. Leah's parents think that the problem was caused by too much medicine. Well, said Dr. Hutchison, that may not be too far from the truth. I stared at him. Go back to Merced, he said, and tell those people at MCMC that the family didn't do this to the kid. We did. Driving back to Merced, I was in a state of shock myself. I had known about Leah's sepsis, but I had always assumed that her seizure disorder had been the root of the problem. The Lees were right after all, I thought. Leah's medicine did make her sick. That night, I told Neil and Peggy what Dr. Hutchison had said. As usual, their desire to ferret out the truth outweighed their desire, if indeed they had one, to defend their reputation for infallibility. They immediately asked for my photocopy of Leah's medical chart, and they sat together on Bill Selvage's sofa, combing Volume 5 for evidence, overlooked during the crisis, that Leah might already have been septic at MCMC, murmuring to each other in their shared secret language. Calcium 3.2, platelets 29,000, hemoglobin 8.4. They might have been, in fact were, a pair of lovers exchanging a set of emotionally charged intimacies. "I always thought Leah got septic shock down at Children's when they put all those invasive lines in," said Peggy. "But maybe not. There are some signs here."
"I did too," said Neil. "If I'd thought she was septic here at MCMC, I would have done a lumbar puncture. I didn't start her on antibiotics because every single time Leah had come in before that, she was not septic. Every other time, the problem was her seizure disorder. And this was obviously the worst seizure of her life. I stabilized her, I arranged for her transport, and then I went home before all the lab results were back."
He didn't sound defensive. He sounded curious. After Neil and Peggy went home, I asked Bill Selvage whether he thought Neil had made a mistake in not recognizing and treating Leah's sepsis, even though Dr. Hutchison believed that her fate was probably sealed before she arrived in the MCMC emergency room, and even though the increasing severity of her epilepsy might eventually have led to serious brain damage if the sepsis had never entered the picture.
"Neil leaves no stone unturned," said Bill. "If Neil made a mistake, it's because every physician makes mistakes. If it had been a brand new kid walking off the street, I guarantee you Neil would have done a septic workup, and you would have caught it. But this was Leah. No one at MCMC would have noticed anything but her seizures. Leah was her seizures."
To MCMC's residents, Leah continued to be her seizures. The memory of those terrifying nights in the emergency room that had taught them how to intubate or start IVs or perform Venus countdowns, they always spoke of Leah in the past tense. In fact, Neil and Peggy themselves frequently referred to Leah's demise, or what may have killed Leah, or the reason Leah died. Dr. Hutchison did the same thing. He had asked me, "Was Leah with her foster parents when she died?" And although I reminded him that Leah was alive, 5 minutes later he said,
"Noncompliance had nothing to do with her death."
It wasn't just absent-mindedness. It was an admission of defeat. Leah was dead to her physicians, in a way, for example, that she was never dead to her social workers, because medicine had once made extravagant claims on her behalf and had had to renounce them. Once I asked Neil if he wished he had done anything differently. He answered as I expected, focusing not on his relationship with the Lees, but on his choice of medication.
"I wish we'd used Depakine sooner," he said. "I wish I'd accepted that it would be easier for the family to comply with one medicine instead of three, even if three seemed medically optimal."
Then I asked, "Do you wish you never met Leah?"
"Oh, no, no, no," his vehemence surprised me. Once I might have said yes, but not in retrospect. Leah taught me that when there is a very dense cultural barrier, you do the best you can, and if something happens despite that, you have to be satisfied with little successes instead of total successes. You have to give up total control. That is very hard for me, but I do try. I think Leah made me into a less rigid person.
The next time I saw Fua, I asked whether she had learned anything from what had happened.
No, she said. I haven't learned. I just feel confused. She was feeding Leah at the time, making baby noises as she spooned pureed zhao, the spinach-like green she had grew in the parking lot, into the slack mouth. I don't understand how the doctors can say that she is going to be like this for the rest of her life, and yet they can't fix her. How can they know the future but not know how to change it? I don't understand that. Well, what do you think Leah's future will hold? I asked. I don't know these things, said Fua. I am not a doctor. I am not a Xinning. But maybe Leah will stay hurt like this. And that makes me cry about what will happen. I gave birth to Leah, so I will always take care of her with all my heart. But when her father and I pass away, who will take care of Leah? Leah's sisters do love her, but even though they love her, maybe they will not be able to take care of her. Maybe they will need to study too hard and work too hard. I am crying to think that they are just going to give Leah away to the Americans. Fo wept soundlessly. Mei Ying embraced her and stroked her hair. I know where the Americans put children like Leah, she continued. I saw a place like that in Fresno where they took Leah once, a long time ago. Fua was recalling a chronic care facility for retarded and disabled children where Leah had been temporarily placed before her year in foster care, while her medications were monitored and stabilized. It was like a house for the dead. The children were so poor and so sad that they just cried. They cried all over. One child had a big head and a really small body. Other children had legs that were all dried up and they just fell on the floor. I have seen this. If the Americans take Leah there, she will want to die. But instead, she will suffer. Fu brushed her tears from her cheeks with the back of her hand, and in a quick, brusque gesture. Then she wiped Leah's mouth far more gently and slowly started to rock her. I am very sad, she said, and I think a lot that if we were still in Laos and not in the United States, maybe Leah would never be like this. The doctors are very, very knowledgeable. Your high doctors, your best doctors. But maybe they made a mistake by giving her the wrong medicine, and they made her hurt like this. If it was a da that made Leah sick like this in Laos, we would know how to go to the forest and get herbs to fix her, and maybe she would be able to speak. But this happened here, in the United States, and the Americans have done this to her, and our medicine cannot fix that. It was also true that if the Lees were still in Laos, Leah would probably have died before she was out of her infancy from a prolonged bout of untreated status epilepticus. American medicine had both preserved her life and compromised it. Since that night with Fua, I have replayed the story over and over again, wondering if anything could have made it turn out differently. Despite Dr. Hutchison's revisionist emendation of the final chapter, no one could deny that if the Lees had given Leah her anticonvulsants from the beginning, she might have had, might still be having, something approaching a normal life. What was not clear was who, if anyone, should be held accountable. What if Neil had prescribed Depakine earlier? What if, instead of placing Leah in foster care, he had arranged for a visiting nurse to administer her medications? What if he had sought out Blia Yao Muo or Jonas Vangay or another Hmong leader who straddled both cultures and had asked him to intervene with the Lees, thus transferring the issue of compliance to a less suspect source? What if MCMC had had better interpreters? When I presented my what-if list to Dan Murphy one day at the MCMC cafeteria, he was less interested in the Depakine than in the interpreters. However, he believed that the gulf between the Lees and their doctors was unbridgeable and that nothing could have been done to change the outcome. Until I met Leah, he said, I thought if you had a problem, you could always settle it if you just sat and talked long enough. But we could have talked to the Lees until we were blue in the face. We could have sent the Lees to medical school with the world's greatest translator, and they would still think their way was right and ours was wrong. Dan slowly stirred his lukewarm cocoa. He had been on all-night call. Leah's case ended my idealistic way of looking at the world. Was the gulf unbridgeable? I kept returning obsessively to the Lees' earliest encounters with MCMC during Leah's infancy, when no interpreters were present and her epilepsy was misdiagnosed as pneumonia. Instead of practicing veterinary medicine, what if the residents in the emergency room had managed to elicit the Lees' trust at the outset, or at least managed not to crush it, by finding out what they believed, feared, and hoped? Janine Hilt had asked them for their version of the story, but no doctor ever had. Martin Kilgore had tried, but by then it was years too late. Of course, the Lees' perspective might have been as unfathomable to the doctors as the doctors' perspective was to the Lees. Hmong culture, as Blia Yao Mua observed to me, is not Cartesian. Nothing could be more Cartesian than Western medicine. Trying to understand Leah and her family by reading her medical chart, something I spent hundreds of hours doing, was like deconstructing a love sonnet by reducing it to a series of syllogisms. Yet to the residents and pediatricians who cared for her since she was 3 months old, there was no guide to Leah's world except her chart. As each of them struggled to make sense of a set of problems that were not expressible in the language they knew, the chart simply grew longer and longer, until it contained more than 400,000 words. Every one of those words reflected its author's intelligence, training, and good intentions, but not a single one dealt with the Lees' perception of their daughter's illness. Almost every discussion of cross-cultural medicine that I had ever read quoted a set of 8 questions designed to elicit a patient's explanatory model, which were developed by Arthur Kleinman, a psychiatrist and medical anthropologist who chairs the Department of Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. The first few times I read these questions, they seemed so obvious I hardly noticed them. Around the 50th time, I began to think that, like many obvious things, they might actually be a work of genius. I recently decided to call Kleinman to tell him how I thought the Lees might have answered his questions after Leah's earliest seizures, before any medications had been administered, resisted, or blamed, if they had had a good interpreter and had felt sufficiently at ease to tell the truth. To wit, 1. What do you call the problem? Kaudape. That means the spirit catches you and you fall down. 2. What do you think has caused the problem? Soul loss. 3. Why do you think it started when it did? Leah's sister Yer slammed the door and Leah's soul was frightened out of her body. 4. What do you think the sickness does? How does it work? It makes Leah shake and fall down. It works because a spirit called a da is catching her. 5. How severe is the sickness? Will it have a short or long course? Why are you asking us those questions? If you are a good doctor, you should know the answers yourself. 6. What kind of treatment do you think the patient should receive? What are the most important results you hope she receives from this treatment? You should give Leah medicine for a week, but no longer. After she is well, she should stop taking the medicine. You should not treat her by taking her blood or the fluid from her backbone. Leah should also be treated at home with our Hmong medicines and by sacrificing pigs and chickens. We hope Leah will be healthy but we are not sure we want her to stop shaking forever because it makes her noble in our culture, and when she grows up, she might become a shaman. 7. What are the chief problems the sickness has caused? It has made us sad to see Leah hurt, and it has made us angry at Yir. 8. What do you fear most about the sickness? That Leah's soul will never return. I thought Kleiman would consider these responses so bizarre that he would be at a loss for words. When I had presented this same material, more or less, to Neil and Peggy, they had said, "Mr. and Mrs. Lee thought, what?" But after each answer, he said with great enthusiasm, "Right!" Nothing surprised him. Everything delighted him. From this vantage point, a physician could encounter no more captivating a patient than Leah, no finer a set of parents than the Lees. Then I told him what had happened later. The Lees' noncompliance with Leah's anticonvulsant regimen, the foster home, the neurological catastrophe, and asked him if he had any retroactive suggestions for her pediatricians.
"I have 3, he said briskly. "First, get rid of the term compliance. It's a lousy term. It implies moral hegemony. You don't want a command from a general. You want a colloquy. Second, instead of looking at a model of coercion, look at a model of mediation. Go find a member of the monk community, or go find a medical anthropologist who can help you negotiate. Remember that a stance of mediation, like a divorce proceeding, requires compromise on both sides. Decide what's critical and be willing to compromise on everything else. Third, you need to understand that as powerful an influence as the culture of the Hmong patient and her family is on this case, the culture of biomedicine is equally powerful. If you can't see that your own culture has its own set of interests, emotions, and biases, how can you expect to deal successfully with someone else's culture?" Chapter 18. The Life or the Soul. I do not know if Leah would be able to walk and talk today had she been treated by Arthur Kleinman instead of Neil Ernst and Peggy Philp. However, I have come to believe that her life was ruined not by septic shock or non-compliant parents, but by cross-cultural misunderstanding. Leah's case, or narrative, as Kleinman would put it, since he believes every illness is not a set of pathologies but a personal story, was one of perhaps 100 Hmong medical cases I heard about over the years. Most turned out badly. The sample is probably skewed, since doctors and patients remember calamities, their own and others', more vividly than they remember successes. Still, the imbalance is disquieting. A child in San Diego was born with a hare lip. Her doctors asked the parents' permission to repair it surgically. They cited the ease of the operation, the social ostracism to which the child would otherwise be condemned. Instead, the parents fled the hospital with their baby. Several years earlier, while the family was escaping from Laos to Thailand, the father had killed a bird with a stone, but he had not done so cleanly, and the bird had suffered. The spirit of that bird had caused the hare lip. To refuse to accept the punishment would be a grave insult. A child in Michigan had a retinoblastoma, a malignant tumor of the eye. His doctors asked the parents' permission to remove his eye in order to prevent metastasis. His parents fled the state, certain that if their son had the surgery, he would be reincarnated over and over again with an incomplete body. A child in Minnesota had a spinal deformity. His doctors asked his parents for permission to perform corrective surgery. After his birth in a Thai refugee camp, a Tsinning had told the parents that the boy was destined for greatness as a Hmong leader. The Tsinning also warned that if the boy's body were ever altered, his parents would die. A few days later, his parents reluctantly acceded to the operation. But before it was performed, his father died. His mother fled the state with her son. A woman in Merced who had delivered 5 children without complications arrived at the hospital in the final stage of labor with her 6th child. Observing that the umbilical cord had prolapsed, a potentially fatal problem if the cord is compressed by the baby's head, the nurses attempted to relieve pressure on the cord by forcing the woman to crouch on her hands and knees and pushing the head back inside the birth canal while screaming at the husband to sign a consent form for a cesarean section. He did so under duress, but while his wife was being prepared for surgery, the baby was born vaginally. No interpreter was present. The parents believed that the nurses wished to harm the baby because they thought Hmong refugees had too many children, and the doctor wished to perform surgery in order to make a larger profit. Accordingly, the mother decided to give birth to all her future children at home. There were, of course, some good outcomes, mostly not in pediatric cases. Here are 3. A young combat veteran who had just arrived in the United States attempted to hang himself in the shower room of the California Transit facility in which he had been temporarily placed. During the next several days, he was isolated in a hospital room, offered American food, and forced to submit to a comprehensive medical workup, including blood tests. He neither ate nor slept. Finally, his doctors discontinued the blood work. They gave him Hmong food, and he ate. They let a Hmong man stay with him overnight, and he slept. Learning that he had feared he would be unable to feed his children, they explained the mechanics of refugee cash assistance and showed him photographs of his future home. He and his family resettled successfully in Iowa. A middle-aged man in Merced, hospitalized for an infection, was asked by an interpreter who was filling out a routine nursing admission form whether he wished, in case of death, to donate his organs. The man, believing that his doctors planned to let him die and take his heart, became highly agitated and announced that he was leaving the hospital immediately. The interpreter managed to calm him down and assured him that the doctors' intentions were honorable. The man stayed until his recovery a few days later, and a sympathetic hospital administrator, anticipating similar misunderstandings with other Hmong patients, fought successfully to have the organ donor box removed from the admission form. A hospital social worker in San Francisco, accompanied by an interpreter, was sent by the public health department to visit a woman with tuberculosis who had refused to take her isoniazid tablets. The social worker, whose name was Francesca Farr, began to talk to the patient who was in her 8th month of pregnancy. "No, no," said the interpreter. "You should talk to her husband." So Farr asked the husband why he didn't want his wife to take the medicine. "No, no," said the interpreter. "Don't ask him that yet. First, you should wish him some things." Farr told the husband she wished that his children would never be sick and that their rice bowls would never be empty, and that his family would always stay together and that his people would never be in another war. As she spoke, the husband's hands, which had been clenched, relaxed. "Now," said the interpreter, "you can ask him why his wife isn't taking the medicine." Farr did. The husband answered that if she took the medicine, their baby would be born without arms or legs. Farr touched the patient's abdomen and told the husband that if the baby didn't already have arms and legs, the woman wouldn't be so big, and the baby wouldn't be kicking. The husband nodded, walked into the other room, returned with a giant bottle, dumped the contents into Farr's hands, and said that his wife could take the pills. This last case warrants particular scrutiny because Francesca Farr did a number of things that generally weren't done at MCMC and certainly weren't done with Leah. she made a house call. She took along a capable and assertive interpreter whom she treated as a cultural broker, by definition her equal and in this case her superior, not a translator, her inferior. She worked within the family's belief system. She did not carry her belief system, which included a feminist distaste for being forced to deal with the husband instead of the wife, into the negotiations. She never threatened, criticized, or patronized. She said hardly anything about Western medicine. She flew completely by the seat of her pants. Also, Francesca Farr liked the Hmong. Loved them, I should say. That was something she had in common with everyone I knew who had ever worked successfully with Hmong patients, clients, or research subjects. Dan Murphy once said that of the 10 most admirable people he had met in the last decade, 7 or 8 were Hmong. Janine Hilt told me that if her house caught on fire, the first thing she would grab was a framed pandao that Pho had stitched for her. It still hangs in a position of honor over her partner's dining table. Suki Waller said that after she spent time with her Hmong clients, Americans, by comparison, seemed dry. The anthropologists Eric Crystal and Dwight Conkergood were so intoxicated by Hmong culture that their ethnographic commentaries, while academically impeachable, sometimes sounded like mash notes. Neil and Peggy liked the Hmong, too, but they did not love them. They could have had a practice full of white, middle-class patients who always took their medicine and whose insurance companies always paid on time. Instead, because they were altruists, they had the antithesis. Their choice was morally satisfying, but whenever a patient crossed the compliance line, thus sabotaging their ability to be optimally effective doctors, cultural diversity ceased being a delicious spice and became a disagreeable obstacle. Neil and Peggy were excellent physicians, but by Kleiman's definition, a concern for the psychosocial and cultural facets that give illness context and meaning. They were, at least during their early years with Leah, imperfect healers. But love, unlike the etiology and diagnosis of pediatric seizures, cannot be taught. It can only be granted. I believe that Neil and Peggy now love Pho. In its absence, is there anything else that doctors can do to take better care of their Hmong patients? Bruce Taupau Blitu, the Hmong medical administrator who wrote about mental health problems as traditional ailments of the liver, has some suggestions. Not surprisingly, almost all of them are cultural, not medical. To improve Hmong health care in general, arrange for female doctors to treat female patients and male doctors to treat male patients. Involve the patients' families in all decisions. Use interpreters who are both bilingual and bicultural. To persuade Hmong people to undergo necessary surgery and to improve the outcomes if they consent, enlist the support of family and community leaders. Minimize blood drawing. Allow relatives or friends in the hospital room around the clock. Allow shamanistic ceremonies in the hospital. To improve mental health, encourage traditional arts such as weaving, music, dance, and silversmithing. Acknowledge Hmong contributions to U.S. military operations in Laos. Promote clan reunification through secondary resettlement. Be careful not to undercut the father's authority in Hmong families. Give refugees more opportunities to help themselves. Fuss over them less. Most important, says Blitu, and many others as well, practice conjoint treatment. That is, integrate Western allopathic medicine with traditional healing arts, or as Nikau Lee put it, use a little medicine and a little Ning. Kleinman, who has commented that the doctor cures the disease, but the indigenous healer heals the illness, believes that conjoint treatment does more than promote trust between the doctor and the patient. Because illness is so profoundly affected by psychosocial factors, it actually improves the outcome. Although the Lees did treat Leah with herbs, dermal therapies, and animal sacrifices, their regimen ran parallel to Leah's medical course rather than intertwining with it. While Neil and Peggy were dimly aware of some of these remedies, for example, when Leah had marks on her chest from coin rubbing, but they never asked about them, and they certainly never recommended them. It would never have occurred to them to emulate Luis Estevez, a pediatrician at Lincoln Hospital in the Bronx, who has referred Puerto Rican and Dominican patients to a Santeria high priest, as he might refer them to an ophthalmologist, or Yasmin Collazo, a psychiatrist at Elmhurst Hospital Center in Queens, who has allowed a Mexican curandero, or folk healer, to perform a cleansing ceremony in the hospital for a schizophrenic patient. Dr. Collazo said that after the visit, the patient was far more compliant in taking her antipsychotic medications, which she believed the curandero had sanctified. Blit, too, wrote, "Since Hmong health treatments never hurt anyone but could possibly help a patient, they should be seriously considered as part of a client's course of treatment." Unfortunately, his first premise is not always true. Some folk remedies contain arsenic, lead, and opium. However, intervention by a Tsineng, whose work is conducted entirely on a metaphysical plane, is always safe. And many people, including Blitu, Suki Walker, Dwight Conquergood, and the French anthropologist Jacques Lemoine, believe that because the mind-body dichotomy does not exist in Hmong culture, and because so much illness among Hmong refugees has a psychogenic element, the Tsineng is an ideal collaborator in the healing process. Indeed, according to Conquergood, no one is better qualified to span the gap between the medical and the spiritual. Shamans are the first and last quintessential mediators. They are threshold crossers, endowed creatures who can go between the earth and the sky. Grand articulators, shamans' special gift and mission is to bring opposites together, to bring the physical and moral worlds into meaningful conjunction. That is why they are identified with archetypal connectors such as images of ladders, bridges, ropes, and cosmic trees that sink roots into the earth while branching towards the sky. It is the special responsibility of the shaman to celebrate and actualize the coincidences between these two kingdoms and to amplify their resonances, one into another. Perhaps that is why the shamans do not resist prescription medicine and physical treatments. These forms of medicine do not directly compete with the shamans' manipulation of symbols and management of belief. Indeed, I saw bottles of prescription medicine resting without contradiction on shamans' altars inside thatched huts in Camp Bonvinay. They see the two modes of healing, natural and supernatural, as complementary rather than contradictory. Conquergood should know, having been a Tsineng's patient himself when he had dengue fever. He has described his soul-calling ceremony, which was attended by most of his friends at Bonvinay, and which he claims was truly restorative, as a festive and affectionate drama that was saturated with care and human kindness. Lemoine has commented that a Tsineng is far more like a psychiatrist than like a priest. However, there is a crucial distinction. Comparing his work to psychiatric procedure, I noticed that while the analyst tries to provoke self-analysis by scratching the wounded part of the self, a Hmong shaman will provide an explanation which avoids all self-involvement of the patient. The patient is always represented as a victim of an assault from outside powers or of an accidental separation from one part of his self. When this situation has been identified and overcome by the shaman, health is recovered. At no point has there been a feeling of guilt associated with suffering. When I read this, I thought of how often the Hmong react to threat or blame by fighting or fleeing, which in the medical arena translate to various forms of noncompliance. The Tsineng's exclusion of guilt from the transaction dovetails perfectly with the Hmong temperament. The doctor's a standard message.
If you don't take these pills, have this operation, see me again next Tuesday, you'll be sorry.
Does not. During the mid-80s, the Nationalities Service of Central California in Fresno received a short-term federal grant of $1,965 to establish what is termed an integrated mental health delivery service utilizing Hmong healers and Western mental health providers. 8 Tsinengs were hired as consultants. They treated 250 patients, most of whom had complaints that transcended the usual boundaries of mental health. The resulting project report, which contains descriptions of 18 healing ceremonies, including ceremony to dispel ogre spirits, ceremony to separate this world from that of the afterlife, the ceremony to appease the spirit above the big stove, is one of the most amazing documents ever financed by American taxpayers. Sometimes the ceremony by itself was enough, it concluded. In other cases, once such a ceremony was performed, the client was more amenable to recommended medical procedures, such as surgery or medication, administered by licensed healthcare providers. Here are the report's 3 summaries of 2 cases that had different, though equally positive, resolutions. Case number 3. Complaint. Symptomatology. Gallbladder problem. Mochi. The client suffered from a sharp pain on the right side of the chest extending to the back. He reported inability to engage in any activity other than passive relaxation. Assessment. A licensed physician diagnosed the condition as gallbladder problem requiring surgery for correction. The Neng Tsineng was consulted following this diagnosis. Treatment plan. The Neng performed a ceremony during which healing powers were bestowed on water, which was then used to wash the painful area in order to release the pain. However, the pain persisted, and the client accepted that it was not a spiritual problem. He then returned to the physician and consented to surgery. Result: the surgery was successful, and the client reported that the illness was cured. Case number 9. Complaint, symptomatology. The client's penis had been swollen for about a month. He reported that he'd been treated by licensed physicians, but that the treatment had only given intermittent relief from pain and swelling. Assessment: the Neng determined that the client had offended the stream spirits. Treatment plan: the Neng called upon the Neng spirits to effect a cure and release the pain. The Neng used a bowl of water to spray from the mouth over the infected area. The offended spirits were offered payment of 5 sticks of incense to release the pain and relieve the swelling. Result: the client got better after the ceremony. After 14 months, the grant for the program expired, and as far as I know, that was the first and last penile exorcism to be sponsored by the Department of Health and Human Services. However, in many less recondite ways, the medical establishment appears to be waking up to the fact that since 1990, more than half of the population growth in the United States has come from immigrants and their children, and that many of these immigrants, even if they can get to the hospital and pay for their treatment, may find mainstream health care culturally inaccessible. The 1992 edition of the Merck Manual of Diagnosis and Therapy, the world's most widely used medical text, included for the first time a chapter called Cross-Cultural Issues in Medicine. The chapter was allotted only 3 pages out of 2,844,